Chapter 12, Abraham, a good neighbor in Canaan. Abraham returned to Canaan very rich in cattle, in silver and in gold. Lot was with him, and they came to Bethel and pitched their tents. In the midst of hardships and trials they had dwelt together in harmony, but in their prosperity there was danger of strife. The pasturage was not sufficient for the flocks and herds of both. It was evident that they must separate. Abraham was the first to propose plans for preserving peace. Although the whole land had been given him by God himself, he courteously waived this right. "Let there be no strife," he said, "between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right, or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left." How many under similar circumstances would cling to their individual rights and preferences? How many households, how many churches have been divided, making the cause of truth a byword and a reproach among the wicked? The children of God the world over are one family, and the same spirit of love and conciliation should govern them. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. A willingness to do to others as we would wish them to do to us would annihilate half the ills of life. The heart in which the love of Christ is cherished will possess that charity which seeketh not her own. Lot manifested no gratitude to his benefactor. Instead, he selfishly endeavored to grasp advantages. He lifted up his eyes, and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. The most fertile region in all Palestine was the Jordan Valley, reminding the beholders of the lost paradise and equaling the beauty and productiveness of the Nile-enriched plains they had left. There were cities, wealthy and beautiful, inviting to profitable traffic. Dazzled with visions of worldly gain, Lot overlooked the moral evils encountered there. He chose him all the plain of Jordan, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. How little did he foresee the terrible results of that selfish choice! Abraham soon after this moved to Hebron. In the free air of those upland plains with their olive groves and vineyards, their fields of grain, and the wide pasture of the encircling hills, he dwelt, content with his simple life, leaving to Lot the perilous luxury of Sodom. Abraham did not shut away his influence from his neighbors. His life and character, in contrast to the worshippers of idols, exerted a telling influence in favor of the true faith. His allegiance to God was unswerving, while his affability and benevolence inspired confidence and friendship. While Christ is dwelling in the heart, it is impossible to conceal the light of his presence. It will grow brighter as the mists of selfishness and sin that envelop the soul are dispelled by the Sun of Righteousness. The people of God are lights in the moral darkness of this world. Scattered in towns, cities, and villages, they are God's channels through which he will communicate to an unbelieving world the knowledge and wonders of his grace. It is his plan that all who are partakers of salvation shall be lights that shine forth in the character, revealing the contrast with the darkness of the selfishness of the natural heart. Abraham was wise in diplomacy, and brave and skillful in war. Three royal brothers, rulers of the Amorite plains in which he dwelt, manifested friendship by inviting him to enter an alliance with them for greater security, for the country was filled with violence and oppression. An occasion soon arose for him to avail himself of this alliance. Lot rescued by Abraham. Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, had invaded Canaan years before and made it tributary to him. Several of the princes now revolted, and the Elamite king again marched into the country to reduce them to submission. Five kings of Canaan met the invaders, only to be completely overthrown. The victors plundered the cities of the plain and departed with rich spoil and many captives, among whom were Lot and his family. Abraham learned from one of the fugitives the story of the calamity that had befallen his nephew. All his affection for him was awakened, and he determined that he should be rescued. Seeking divine counsel, Abraham prepared for war. From his own encampment he summoned 318 trained servants, men trained in the fear of God, in the service of their master, and in the practice of arms. His confederates, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner, joined him, and together they started in pursuit of the invaders. The Elamites had encamped at Dan, on the northern border of Canaan. Flushed with victory, they had given themselves up to reveling. The patriarch came upon the encampment by night. His attack, so vigorous and unexpected, resulted in speedy victory. The king of Elam was slain and his panic-stricken forces routed. Lot and his family, with all the prisoners and goods, were recovered, and a rich booty fell into the hands of the victors. Abraham had not only rendered a great service to the country but had proved himself a man of valor. It was seen that Abraham's religion made him courageous in maintaining the right and defending the oppressed. On his return, the king of Sodom came out to honor the conqueror, begging only that the prisoners be restored. The spoils belonged to the conquerors, but Abraham refused to take advantage of the unfortunate, only stipulating that his confederates receive the portion to which they were entitled. Few, if subjected to such a test, would have resisted the temptation to secure so rich a booty. His example is a rebuke to self-seeking. "I have lifted up my hand," he said, "unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich." God had promised to bless Abraham, and to him the glory should be ascribed. Another who came out to welcome the victorious patriarch was Melchizedek, king of Salem. As priest of the Most High God, he pronounced a blessing upon Abraham and gave thanks to the Lord, who had wrought deliverance by his servant, and Abraham gave him tithes of all. Abraham is afraid. Abraham had been a man of peace, so far as possible shunning strife. With horror he recalled the carnage he had witnessed. The nations whose forces he had defeated would doubtless renew the invasion and make him the special object of their vengeance. Furthermore, he had not entered upon the possession of Canaan, nor could he now hope for an heir, to whom the promise might be fulfilled. In a vision of the night the divine voice was again heard, "Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield, and thy exceeding great reward." But how was the covenant promise to be realized while the gift of a son was withheld? "What wilt thou give me," he said, "seeing I go childless? Lo, one born in my house is mine heir." He proposed to make his trusty servant Eliezer his son, by adoption. But he was assured that a child of his own was to be his heir. Then he was told to look up to the unnumbered stars glittering in the heavens, and the words were spoken, "So shall thy seed be." Abraham believed God, and it was counted unto him for righteousness. The Lord condescended to enter into a covenant with his servant. And the voice of God was heard, bidding him not to expect immediate possession of the promised land, and pointing forward to the sufferings of his posterity before their establishment in Canaan. The plan of redemption was open to him in the death of Christ, the great sacrifice, and his coming in glory. Abraham saw also the earth restored to Eden beauty, given for an everlasting possession as the final and complete fulfillment of the promise. When Abraham had been nearly 25 years in Canaan, the Lord appeared unto him and said, "Behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations." In token of the fulfillment of this covenant, his name Abram was changed to Abraham, father of a great multitude. Sarai's name became Sarah, princess, for she shall be a mother of nations, kings of people shall be of her. At this time circumcision was given to Abraham, to be observed by the patriarch and his descendants as a token that they were separated from idolaters and that God accepted them as his peculiar treasure. They were not to contract marriages with heathen, for by so doing they would be tempted to engage in the sinful practices of other nations and be seduced into idolatry. Abraham entertains angels unawares. God conferred great honor upon Abraham. Angels walked and talked with him. When judgments were about to be visited on Sodom, the fact was not hidden from him, and he became an intercessor with God for sinners. In the hot summer noontide, the patriarch was sitting in his tent door when he saw in the distance three travelers. Before reaching his tent, the strangers halted. Without waiting for them to solicit favors, Abraham with the utmost courtesy urged them to honor him by tarrying for refreshment. With his own hands he brought water that they might wash the dust of travel from their feet. He selected food, and while they were at rest under the cooling shade, he stood respectfully beside them while they partook of his hospitality. Years later, this act of courtesy was referred to by an inspired apostle: "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares." Abraham had seen in his guests only three tired wayfarers, little thinking that among them was one whom he might worship without sin. But the true character of the heavenly messengers was now revealed. They were on their way as ministers of wrath, yet to Abraham they spoke first of blessings. God takes no delight in vengeance. Abraham had honored God and the Lord honored him, revealing to him his purposes. "Shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do?" said the Lord. "The cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now, and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which is come unto me. And if not, I will know." God knew Sodom's guilt, but he expressed himself after the manner of men, that his justice might be understood. He would go himself to institute an examination of their course. If they had not passed the limits of divine mercy, he would grant them space for repentance. Two of the heavenly messengers departed, leaving Abraham alone with him whom he now knew to be the Son of God. And the man of faith pleaded for the inhabitants of Sodom. Once he had saved them by his sword, now he endeavored to save them by prayer. Lot and his household were still dwellers there, and Abraham sought to save them from the storm of divine judgment. With deep humility he urged his plea, "I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord, which am but dust and ashes." He did not claim favor on the ground of his obedience or of the sacrifices he had made in doing God's will. Himself a sinner, he pleaded in the sinner's behalf. Yet Abraham manifested the confidence of a child pleading with a loved father. Though Lot had become a dweller in Sodom, he did not partake in the iniquity of its inhabitants. Abraham thought that in that populous city there must be other worshippers of the true God. He pleaded, "That be far from thee, to slay the righteous with the wicked. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" As his requests were granted, he gained the assurance that if even 10 righteous persons could be found in it, the city would be spared. Abraham's prayer for Sodom shows that we should cherish hatred of sin, but pity and love for the sinner. All around us are souls going down to ruin. Every hour some are passing beyond the reach of mercy. Where are the voices of entreaty to bid the sinner flee from this fearful doom? Where are those who are pleading with God for him? Who prays for Sodom today? The spirit of Abraham was the spirit of Christ, himself the great intercessor in the sinner's behalf. Christ manifested toward the sinner a love which infinite goodness alone could conceive. In the agonies of the crucifixion, burdened with the awful weight of the sins of the whole world, he prayed for his murderers, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." The testimony of God is, "Abraham obeyed my voice, and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord, to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. It was a high honor to which Abraham was called, that of being father of the people who were the guardians of the truth of God for the world, through whom all nations should be blessed in the advent of the Messiah. Abraham would keep the law and deal justly and righteously. And he would not only fear the Lord himself but would instruct his family in righteousness. Abraham's household comprised more than 1,000 souls. Here, as in a school, they received such instruction as would prepare them to be representatives of the true faith. He was training heads of families, and his methods of government would be carried out in the households over which they should preside. It was necessary to bind the members of the household together, to build up a barrier against the idolatry that had become widespread. Abraham sought to guard his encampment against mingling with the heathen and witnessing their idolatrous practices. Care was exercised to impress the mind with the majesty and glory of the living God as the true object of worship. God himself had separated Abraham from his idolatrous kindred that the patriarch might educate his family apart from the seductive influences in Mesopotamia, and that the true faith might be preserved in its purity by his descendants. The influence of daily living. Abraham's children and household were taught that they were under the rule of the God of heaven. There was to be no oppression on the part of parents and no disobedience on the part of children. The silent influence of his daily life was a constant lesson. There was a fragrance about the life, a nobility of character, which revealed to all that he was connected with heaven. He did not neglect the humblest servant. In his household, there was not one law for the master and another for the servant. All were treated with justice and compassion as inheritors with him of the grace of life. How few in our day follow this example! On the part of too many parents there is a blind and selfish sentimentalism, miscalled love, manifested in leaving children to the control of their own will. This is cruelty to the youth and a great wrong to the world. Parental indulgence confirms in the young the desire to follow inclination instead of submitting to divine requirements. Thus they grow up to transmit their irreligious, insubordinate spirit to their children and children's children. Let obedience to parental authority be taught as the first step in obedience to the authority of God. The teaching which has become widespread, that the divine statutes are no longer binding, is the same as idolatry in its effect on the morals of the people. Parents do not command their household to keep the way of the Lord. Children, as they make homes of their own, feel no obligation to teach their children what they themselves have never been taught. This is why there are so many godless families, why depravity is so widespread. A reformation is needed, deep and broad. Parents, ministers, need to reform. They need God in their households. They must bring His word into their families and teach their children kindly and untiringly how to live in order to please God. The children of such a household have a foundation that cannot be swept away by the incoming tide of skepticism. In many households, parents feel they cannot spare a few moments in thanksgiving to God for the sunshine and showers and for the guardianship of holy angels. They have no time to offer prayer. They go forth to labor as the ox or the horse, without one thought of God or heaven. The Son of God gave His life to ransom them, but they have little more appreciation of His goodness than beasts that perish. If ever there was a time when every house should be a house of prayer, it is now. Let the father as priest of the household lay upon the altar of God the morning and evening sacrifice, while the wife and children unite in prayer and praise. In such a household Jesus will love to tarry. From every home love should flow out in thoughtful kindness, in gentle, unselfish courtesy. There are homes where God is worshipped and truest love reigns. His mercies and blessings descend upon the suppliants like morning dew. A well-ordered household is a powerful argument in favor of the Christian religion. An influence at work in the family affects the children. The God of Abraham is with them. God speaks to every faithful parent, "I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord, to do justice and judgment.